This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support is from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. Your number, 877-217-5757. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Always a pleasure to talk with you. And, of course, today there is major news in our community. The firing of Coach Ed Orgeron, the fourth winningest football coach in the history of LSU, national champion just 21 months ago, and now out of a job at the end of the season. He will get about $17 million in walking away money, but he is going to be on the streets and says he'll take a year off. And we'll talk more about that later in the hour with Glenn Gilbo. We start our program with Luke Mixon, who's been making news. A young man, 42, right?
That's right.
42 years old. Graduate of the Naval Academy, native of Louisiana, was a student athlete at Bunky High School, and he lives in Baton Rouge now, but Commander Luke Mixon grew up in a farming family. So you have some of the same backstory as one Edwin Washington Edwards. He grew up not so far away in Marksville from a farming family. His dad was a sharecropper. What got you to the Naval Academy? That's quite an odyssey.
Yeah, in high school, I developed a strong relationship with my grandfather. My grandfather was a World War II veteran. He was a flight engineer on B-24s. And throughout the spring of 1944, he flew 18 missions throughout Europe. Unfortunately for us pilots, on his 19th mission, he had what all of us fear is one takeoff, zero landings. Approaching his target, he was shot down by a German ME-109. And it's a really fascinating story. The aircraft catches fire, enters a spin, and starts tumbling to the earth. He scrambles his way, finds his parachute, opens the bomb bay doors, and jumps from 22,000 feet. And he'd remain a prisoner at the Stalag 17B prison camp just outside of Austria for the next year and a half. And he returned home in the summer of 1945 to learn that on that day, of the 10 crew members, only two survived. The other eight perished. And he went on to live a life of patriotism, integrity, character. He was exactly that guy you picture. He started a farm, was a small business owner, had a wonderful family. I really looked up to him. And based upon his story and the conversations we had and his love for this country, I knew that I wanted to serve in the military. And I wanted to be a pilot. So the Naval Academy made a lot of sense to me. And so it was all because of him.
Charles Mixon.
That's right.
So he parachutes. How high up was he when he...
They were at 20,000
feet. 20,000 feet. Uninjured.
Oh, he was injured. So he shatters his right leg. And while he was a prisoner, the Germans will operate on him. They'll put about a 8 to 10-inch steel,
titanium, probably.
Into his leg. And that would remain with him.
The
rest of his life. That's right.
And Stalag 17. There was a movie about that, an Academy Award-winning movie. So I suspect he was treated reasonably well as POWs go, but nobody wants to be in a POW camp. And that was not a fun place to be.
They were treated pretty well. He always told me the scariest part was the Americans, in fact, who were bombing Germany pretty heavily, and they all, they were always nervous of a bomb maybe not going where it was
friendly
supposed to go.
Fire, yeah. That's right. Yeah. But he lived and had a big influence on you. When did he die?
He died in 2006.
So 15 years ago. When you were 27. So he got to see you graduate from the Naval Academy.
He did have a great picture. He visited me twice there, and he got to see me fly the F-18 a few times. So that was very important to me.
Now, John Bel Edwards, when he announced his candidacy for governor on this show in 2013, he noted that when he went to West Point, this would have been in 1984, I believe, that he had to get the two U.S. senators on board to write him letters of recommendation. That would have been Long and Johnston at the time. Did you have to do the same thing with your senators?
I did. I got a nomination from John Brougham, who I had the privilege of speaking with the other day, and that was really neat, just to be in this position that I am now and to reach back to the very person who enabled me to be in this position. Mm-hmm. And that's who I got my nomination from, was John Brougham.
This would have been 24 years ago, I guess.
I got my nomination. That would have been 1996 into 1997.
So Mary Landrieu I guess, would have been the other U.S. senator. It would have been right at the close of Johnston and Landrieu. But Breaux got the job done for you. Congratulations to John Breaux. Always had a great eye for talent, as Jim Nickel and Bob Mann have proved, and others. But you're running against John Kennedy, first time out, right?
That's right.
So 42, and you know, anytime a person is a veteran, a Naval Academy, Louisiana born, you got some great things going for you. Farming, you know a lot about the state, and you have a background different than that of Senator Kennedy, and you're a Democrat. Have you always been a Democrat?
I have. That's right. I've always been a
Democrat.
Why? I think it starts with the way I was raised, but by my parents. My parents always emphasized the dignity and respect for everyone. And I think the Democratic Party in recent history has done more to help the most vulnerable, and they've done more to advance equal opportunity. And I don't agree with everything that the Democratic Party stands for, but I think they try to help those who are most vulnerable, mm-hmm. and that's why I'm a Democrat.
Now, I suppose you're right out of the gate, and we do have a little over a year before the primary, although that in the overall scheme is not a really long time, but you're probably weaving your way through issues. But some of these issues, you know how you stand, by all accounts, John Bel Edwards is a conservative Democrat. Now, Louisiana, he might be a moderate Democrat, but if he were in California, they might be trying to kick him out of the party. He's, quote, pro-life and pro-gun. Where do you stand on those issues?
I'm pro-life as well. I believe there are some exceptions to that, but I don't think the conversation stops at birth, and I think pro-life extends to a person's entire life, and that includes early childhood education, that includes making sure folks have health care, and that another topic that's very important to me that I don't think we discuss enough when it comes to pro-life is ending these forever wars, because that certainly results in a lot of life. And so I am pro-life to answer your question.
Guns?
Guns, I spent my entire life, not my entire life, the last 24 years in defense of the Constitution. I have sworn an oath to the Constitution dozens of times. I've administered the oath that people swear to the Constitution hundreds of times. Mm-hmm. So I support the Second Amendment. In fact, I support all the amendments, and I support the entirety of the Constitution.
All right. So this man, Luke Mixon, who is all of 42 years old, which means he probably born in 1979.
That's correct.
What's your birthday?
September 11th.
September 11th. So you were 22 years old the day the buildings came down in New York City.
That's right. You know, it's funny. I graduated. You know, as a kid, I had three goals, right? I wanted to go to Naval Academy. I wanted to be a fighter pilot, and I wanted to go to Top Gun. And I was really fortunate to accomplish all those. What I didn't realize that I graduated three and a half months prior to 9/11. I was in flight school when that event occurred, and it certainly shaped the trajectory for the rest of my career. I'll go into being an F-18 pilot, and you know, a lot of that time was spent on an aircraft carrier in the Middle East. My career almost perfectly captures our time in Afghanistan. That 20 years that we were in Afghanistan exactly mirror the time that I was in the military. I completed four deployments, one to the South China Sea, two to Afghanistan, and then one to Iraq, all flying F-18s off of aircraft carriers.
So you were in war zones.
That's right. Yeah, I did Operation Enduring Freedom twice. I did Operation Iraqi Freedom once. And then, you know, I was when ISIS started making their march out of Syria into Iraq in the fall, I guess that would have been the summer to fall of 2014 into the winter of 2015, we had just arrived on station. So we called a little lesser known mission. It was called Operation Inherent Resolve. And I was there at that time as well.
877-217-5757, war veteran, Commander Luke Mixon, graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy, native of Bunky, Louisiana, where many great Louisiana luminaries have hailed, and he is running for the United States Senate against the man from Centerville, Mississippi, the Honorable John Neely Kennedy. And a listener, this is Hal in Monroe. He asks about Senator Kennedy, born in 1951, went to college during Vietnam, I'm sure got draft deferments. You took a different approach. You decided to fight for our country. really fight. And most people did what Kennedy did, by the way. Almost every president in the and vice president of the U.S. did, except for Al Gore. But most of them took a powder in Vietnam. That's a different time. So is that analogous to what you went through? He was born in 1951. You were born in 1979. Can you compare the two as far as what he did and what you did at different times in serving the U.S. in uniform?
Well, I'm not familiar with Senator Kennedy's participation in the military or lack thereof. I can just talk about myself, which is what I'd like to focus on, and it was certainly important to me to serve. It's exactly what I think we need right now. You know, often I get asked, "Hey, Luke, why are you doing this?" And the answer is that I think we're desperate for responsible leadership. You know, so often right now we see the fear and the division and the hate, and that doesn't serve anyone well in Louisiana.
877-217-5757. We'll go to the phone lines after this 90-second pause. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. A bit more time with Luke Mixon, candidate for U.S. Senate. Right now, the first candidate out of the box, and he has Jared Arsamaugh handling his campaign, among others, and he's the same guy who got the West Point graduate, John Bell Edwards, to the mansion with help from others, including Mary Patricia Ray. But he's got a team together, and if he gains momentum, and polls will determine that, I'm sure he will get lots of contributions, and I'm sure he's getting some now from people who are contributing largely to him because they don't like John Kennedy. But John Kennedy's raising lots of money, too, and I'm getting emails from him, and he's taking you seriously. You must take that as a compliment.
I do take that as a compliment, and we launched, just under 2 weeks ago, and I've been overwhelmed with the support and the email, text messages, phone calls, both from people in Louisiana and through people throughout the nation, and a lot of that support is coming from, you know, the veterans I've served with for the last 20 years who are, as I was saying before we went to break, are just absolutely desperate for responsible leadership. I think people of my background and my experience, I've worked with, you know, people through from such a diverse group of people, and I think what we need in this country right now is moderation and civility, and folks who represent or who care more about the people they represent and the country they represent than themselves or their political party, and that's really why I'm doing this.
877-217-5757 for Luke Mixon. Remember the name. He'll be out there in the next year, and all signs are that he may very well be the Democratic choice. Party will nominate a candidate. I suspect you are confident you're going to get that nomination.
I am. Yeah, okay. I'm confident.
But to show you the difficult proposition this is, John Neely Kennedy has just announced, and he sent this to us as we're doing the show, knowing we're on with Luke Mixon, that he has raised $15 million for his campaign. $15 million. He brought in $3.25 million this quarter, $9.8 million cash on hand. John Neely Kennedy is armed and ready for Luke Mixon, the naval veteran. David in Atlanta. David, you're on with Luke Mixon. Please be brief. Hi, David. Good morning.
Good morning. You know, even Steve Scalise supports wind power off the coast of Louisiana. Louisiana was just devastated. People died. You're going to pay more in insurance. You're going to pay more in utilities because of Hurricane Ida. The hurricanes will get more frequent and more fierce, and John Kennedy will not sign on. Not one Republican in the Senate will sign on to President Biden's infrastructure bill.
All right. Do you support the infrastructure bill?
Absolutely. You know, he mentioned Hurricane Ida. In the last year, we've had two hurricanes devastate the coast of Louisiana. We had a nice storm in North Louisiana that kept people without water for 5 days. This bill, first of all, anything that 69 senators agree on in this country is probably a good thing. You know, we finally see what the American people want, right, which is...
And on this one, there's some division between Kennedy and his senior counterpart, Morgan Cassidy.
Yeah, and we finally see what people want, which is compromise and bipartisanship. And this is a bill that's good for Louisiana. It provides the roads and bridges, ports, waterways, drainage.
Patricia in Magnolia Woods. Patricia, you're on with Luke Mixon.
Hi. I was wondering, what if you got elected, what would your legislative priorities be kind of for Louisiana? Thanks.
All right. Major legislative priorities?
Well, I think we were hitting on the first one. The first one is Louisiana is desperate for infrastructure. We see, you know, we have roads that are deteriorating. We have a healthcare system with the prices are skyrocketing. So those would be two things I would start with is expanded internet access, improving our roads, our bridges, our ports, and then our healthcare system. We've seen how COVID has affected Louisiana, and thanks to the governor's expansion of Medicaid, it has provided health insurance to over 500,000 folks, and that's been critical for our survival during this pandemic, and I would certainly do all I can to preserve that that healthcare system for our people.
Thank you, Patricia. Henry at the Country Club of Louisiana. Hi, Henry. You're on with Luke Mixon.
Hello, Mr. Luke. Hello, Mr. Jim. Happy Monday morning to y'all gentlemen. Mr. Luke, I just want to encourage you and commend you for not looking towards Mar-a-Lago for your direction, because it seems like the folks in there now have a fear that they're going to offend that person down there. And I want to thank you for representing the people of Louisiana as opposed to him. Thank you.
Well, thank you for your comments.
What's your impression of President Trump?
President Trump and I, we have different views on character, and mostly we have different views on patriotism. President Trump seems more concerned with symbols of patriotism than he is actual patriotism. And I've always said that patriotism is something that is measured by how you've used your time, talents, and treasure to improve this nation. It's something my family and I have dedicated our lives to for the last 24 years. And I think more is needed.
Luke Mixon with us for a while longer. By the way, he's been married more than 20 years, married his high school sweetheart, Renee. They have two children, 22 and 8. So they've spread them out, and he has one marriage, as does Senator Kennedy, by the way. President Trump has one more marriage than Kennedy and Mixon put together. Mike in Villa Del Rey. Mike, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
One of the simple pleasures in life, calling Talk Louisiana. Mr. Mixon, you got a low bar to get my vote, okay? But my question is, under any circumstances, even if the president was in the same party as you, would you support him if he tried to overthrow the government like our former President Trump?
All right. Your thoughts?
To answer the question very directly, no. We have to – reasonable people can disagree on issues. We can disagree on what the taxes should be, for example. Reasonable people cannot disagree on the truth, and particularly when it comes to a very important truth, which is the free and fair elections – which by all credible counts were accurate. And so, no, I would not support that whatsoever.
Alan in Albuquerque. Alan, you're on Talk Louisiana. Good morning to you.
Yes, sir. It's Alan Kirkpatrick. I've listened to the story of Ms. Mixon's grandfather, and it sounded so familiar when I realized that who he was. My father was the other person who survived that B-17 crash, and spent 18 months in Starlack 17B. Just interesting parallel there.
That is an interesting parallel. My goodness. Your grandfather and this gentleman's, I think he said his grandfather.
The other gentleman's name was James Carmel, was the pilot's name. And I hope we're talking about the same story.
Yeah, and parachuted 20,000 feet. And your grandfather's leg was shattered, but he survived. And you mentioned Trump. Remember that statement he said about McCain? My heroes don't get captured. And here's a guy who was a draft dodger, got out with fake bone spurs, and talking about people who were heroes. Shame on Donald John Trump. Dan downtown. Dan, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Yes, Mr. Mixon. Is there any concern that the Republican money men will bankroll a black Democrat in the primary in order to soften you up for the runoff?
All right, if there is a runoff. Now, I think if Luke Mixon makes a runoff, that's about the best you can hope for. You're running against a guy who's an incumbent, who's popular in Louisiana. John Kennedy's popular. $15 million that he's raised? Come on now. He makes a runoff, then it's a new ball game.
That's right. That's right. And as far as the question is concerned, I've never spent my life worrying about what others do. I just worry about what I do. And that's all I can control. And that's all I plan on doing is worrying about me. And things will all work out.
Now, it's apparent you have this reverence for the military based on your grandfather. How did you think, you know, politics is for me? Because there's a few, there aren't many, but a few people who have resumes like yours who just say, I don't want any part of this. Why are you diving in?
Because it's the right thing to do. For the same reasons that I wanted to join the military, the same reasons I want to do this, our country is desperate for responsible leadership. I've been asked, Luke, what you have no experience in politics, how can you be up for this? Well, the answer is, if you want a career politician who's climbed his way up the political ladder for his own self-benefit, I am not the person. If you want a person who's spent his entire life taking care of people and looking out for the needs of others,
mm-hmm.
I have a wealth of knowledge in that topic, and I can bring, and it's the same skill.
We're going to spend a few more minutes with Luke Mixon. Your number 877-217-5757. Then we'll hear from Jason Berry on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757. A few more minutes with Luke Mixon, candidate for the U.S. Senate. And this is the start of the final few days of the fall membership drive. This week will be it, so we don't do it this often, and we want to thank all of you who supported us last week and supported this hour of programming. And right before the end of the hour, we hit our mark, and we got 30 contributions in the hour between 9 and 10 on Friday, and we'd like to keep that momentum going. 855-893-9753 to support the treasure that is WRKF this hour and all the others that you've relied upon for 41 and a half years. And I do want to note in the remaining moments, the waning moments of last Friday, Amanda Gibson and Thomas Kemp called to contribute, as did Lenore Feeney, Buzz Landry, Scott Clemens, Jordan Kelman, Les Kirkland. Thanks to all of you. And once again, we'd like to hear from you. If you've never contributed, whatever amount is comfortable for you, it'd be nice to get you on the membership rolls and for you to become a member of the family. 855-893-9753. We're wrapping it up with Luke Mixon. I'm sure we'll have him back, and certainly we would like to talk with Senator Kennedy about his campaign. He's raised $15 million, and he's still asking for money in a very aggressive way. He is, if nothing else, he is a great fundraiser. And Luke Mixon, who's never done this before, is taking on a Louisiana titan of politics in John Neely Kennedy. Charles on Jefferson. Charles, please be brief. You're on with Luke. Hi, Charles. Good morning to you. Are you there, Charles? Okay. We may have lost Charles at least temporarily. And Alondra, tell me when we go to the next line. Who do we have waiting in the wings in our final moments with Mr. Mixon? We had Kennedy versus Nixon in 1960. And in 2022, we've got Kennedy versus Mixon. That's somebody in Morgan City, I believe. Who is it? Okay. Do we go to him? Nope. Okay. So she's saying, hold on, don't do it. Not yet. Okay. 877-217-5757 if you'd like to get in. Jason Berry is on deck as well. But Luke Mixon, you're fully aware that you're in some ways tilting at windmills here. If handicappers in Washington were handicapping this race, I'm sure they would say there's about a 95% chance that John Kennedy will win, but based on that 5% chance you're in the race, is that enough to keep you going against all odds?
Jim, if I listened to everyone who ever told me something was be hard or difficult, I wouldn't be sitting right here. The first person I told I would want to do with my life, I was applying to Boys State, and I was a junior in high school, and I told the gentleman there accepting us, I said, I want to go to the Naval Academy, I want to be a fighter pilot, and I want to go to Top Gun. He laughed at me. So I'm not too concerned about challenges or hard work.
All right. Well, you have that pedigree that many would desire, graduating from one of the military academies. A listener asked, how was the experience at Annapolis?
It was great. In fact, this weekend, I'm going up there for my 20th reunion. I remember being at the Naval Academy, and people tell me it would fly by, and I kind of laughed at that. And sure enough, it has. I'm going back to the Naval Academy this weekend. My wife and I are going up there, and it's certainly contributed a lot to the person I am today, and has instilled in me those characteristics of duty, honor, and loyalty. And, you know, in fact, that was our mission there at the Naval Academy, to instill duty, honor, and loyalty. And I think those are the things we need right now in this country to bring some civility back to our government.
Thank you for joining us. I'm sure we'll have occasion to talk again if you'll come back. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you, Jim.
And now we are joined by Jason Barry. We visited with Jason a few times through the years, and he is one of the best reporters in the world. And when his obit is written, he, I hope, will get the credit he deserves, and it is credit for something that is very personal for him as a practicing Roman Catholic. He is the reporter who first brought the controversy, the misconduct by priests in the Catholic Church to light, and he did so 30 years ago. The first major book on the issue was Lead Us Not Into Temptation, Catholic Priests and the Sexual Abuse of Children, and he has been busy with this story and others in the last three decades, and we've had him on this program to talk about his book, which is one of the definitive books about his city of New Orleans, City of a Million Dreams, and now there is a documentary that will be launched in two nights at the Broad Theater, 631 North Broad Street in New Orleans, appropriately titled City of a Million Dreams. And good morning to you, Jason Barry.
Jim, thank you. Pleasure to be with you as always.
Well, sometimes when you do a book, as you know, it's a process translating that book from print to film, but you have done it, and the early reviews are quite exceptional. So tell us about how you got this process going and what the finished product will look like when people see it.
Well, the film uses burial traditions as a lens on the evolution of New Orleans. Part of it is based on different jazz funerals that I filmed going back to the late 1990s. I had Ford Foundation support for the early phase. And then another run of funerals, you might say, from roughly 2015 up to 2020. And in between, I was working on other projects, including a couple of books about the Vatican. But I kept coming back to New Orleans and going to funerals and filming them. And as I worked on the book, I realized that one could tell the story of a city through its burial traditions. So the book, City of a Million Dreams, which came out in 2018, is a narrative history of New Orleans, and the thread running through it is how these burial traditions evolved. The film, of course, at 89 minutes, has to be a lot tighter than what you, well, what a written narrative affords. But we've got a long section on the Mardi Gras Indians, another section on the Congo Square dances of enslaved Africans. We did a rather extensive dramatization of that in 2018. We filmed in Belle Chasse, thanks to the Plaquemine Parish government. And as you say, the film is getting pretty strong reviews. We're happy for that. It's going to be shown Wednesday night next week at the Broadside, which is the outside component to the Broad Theater, and then next Thursday night at the Ashe Cultural Center on Aretha Castle Haley right, Boulevard.
So is that the 20th and the 21st?
That's correct.
So it's in a couple of nights. It'll show first at the Broad Theater, which is, for all intents, the premiere, and then the next night, is it? Where is it, Jason?
The Ashe Cultural Center on Aretha Castle, Haley Boulevard. The film will also be streaming virtually on the website of the New Orleans Film Festival starting next Thursday. And we have outreach screenings coming together for the coming weeks.
City of a Million Dreams, the book, examined 300 years of New Orleans history through the lens of music, culture, and race. This is a narrower focus, largely about cemeteries in New Orleans, and New Orleans is, last week we started Monday with Trina Edwards, the widow of Edwin Edwards, and how she had her husband exhumed and cremated. Well, in New Orleans, we make a big deal about how people die and how we celebrate them when they die. And then when they're gone, we celebrate them some more, don't we?
I think that's a good way to put it. Yeah, Edwin Edwards did not get a jazz funeral. Every one of these funerals with music, as the musicians, before the age of television called them, in the first half of the 20th century, every one of these is almost like a freeze frame or a short story about the city at a given point in time. That is the lesson I learned over many years doing library research, going through archival accounts, and then looking at footage from the 50s and 60s. It is fascinating to me how images can capture the texture of a city and its culture at a certain time. And of course, the written accounts, the eyewitness accounts that we have going back many years do the same thing. The first funeral with music I was able to document in the book was that of Carlos III, the King of Spain, in 1789. New Orleans at that time had become a Spanish colonial property. And when the king died, the news came to the Cabildo 4 months late, and they immediately ordered a lavish funeral procession with a band, with people processing behind the band. They were referred to as the illustrious body, capital I, capital B. And we don't know what songs the band played, but we know that all the prominent citizens were processing behind the band. So I think from that taproot, the way in which marching bands played funerals, and the parallel tradition of the enslaved Africans dancing in rings. Ring dances were the burial choreographies paying homage to their ancestors. As those two traditions emerged really side by side, gradually they began to come together after the Civil War. It's the coming together of the ring and the ring of African memory, the line of European bands. And we have a sequence on that in the film as well.
Well, it's going to be the definitive work on jazz funerals. And, of course, many of the music luminaries from New Orleans are interviewed in the 89 minutes that is City of a Million Dreams that premieres this week. It's the title song, or a title of a song by musician Raymond Burke, who's person that in the jazz world is well known, and the book's themes and research carried over to the film, and we'll talk more about it. City of a Million Dreams at the movie theater after this with Jason Barry. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. A bit more time with Jason Barry, world-class writer and now decorated filmmaker. His debut of his book turned to the big screen. The documentary City of a Million Dreams premieres Wednesday at the New Orleans Film Festival. Clancy Dubose says, sometimes even those of us whose roots reach back more than a century in New Orleans need to be reminded of how different we are in this city of contrasts and contradictions. Growing up amid the layered and textured richness of our culture, the sights, the sounds, the smells, and the rituals, we can take for granted just how precious and how fragile our culture is. He notes the film opens with a recreation of ring dancers in Congo Square, which originally covered several square miles, through music, images, and narration. It traces the rich African tradition of dance and drum beats, as in the words of the book, a quaking drama of memory and resistance. And obviously, New Orleans is one of the most diverse cities in America. And when you're doing a project like this, the diversity is celebrated as it should be, Jason.
We tried to put a spotlight on the social mosaic of the city. New Orleans is a crossroads of humanity. Historically, it has been. People, of course, think of the French and Spanish and African layers of the Creole culture, but It has also been a place that in the 19th century attracted a great number of Irish immigrants, 80,000 from Sicily over a period of about 40 years, culminating in right after the First World War. And in more recent years, there have been a good many people from Honduras, Mexico, and Vietnam. So the nature of a city like this emerges through sometimes contradictory impulses. You know, funerals, at least in the Christian context or the Roman Catholic context, I should say that's the one I came up in, were very somber, solemn affairs. And yet, when you start following jazz funerals, some of them now emanating from Catholic churches, as they have for a good while now, you realize that the emphasis is on the celebration of the soul's release to the afterlife, hence the up-tempo dancing of the second liners with their spontaneous choreographies in the street. So I think the funerals really do carry a mirror across time. They're like caravans of memory. At least that's how we treated them in the film, and as I did as well in the book.
Well, the October 20th screening, as in Wednesday night, for City of a Million Dreams will be at the Broad Theater, 631 North Broad Street. The time on that, Jason, is when?
It's 7 o'clock, and it's actually at the Broad Side, which is the outdoor seating area close to the theater. So it's going to be under the stars. And then Thursday night, the 21st, we'll be showing it at the Ashe Cultural Center on Aretha Castle Haley Boulevard. And we have other outreach screenings that will be announced in the coming days. Those listeners who live rather far from New Orleans and can't make it can watch the film virtually by going on to the New Orleans Film Festival website starting Thursday.
Well, I noted with our previous guest that Senator Kennedy's raised $15 million in his reelection quest, and I'm sure he'll raise more. You did this on what is now a shoestring budget, $1 million, didn't you? And had lots of help from your friends to do it.
Well, it was a little south of $1 million, and yeah, I guess being a senator, you know where the deep pockets are. I did have good support from the Ford Foundation out of the box. Later on, a number of the Baton Rouge Area Foundation was quite helpful through Paige Royer, and the Almar Foundation through Jack Laborde, who was a classmate of mine at Jesuit, helped out. But the film came together, and we were able to do the major homestretch filming and editing because of Bernard Pettengill, who was 2 years ahead of me in high school. He was a defensive and offensive end on the football team. I never would have pegged him for a forensic accountant and specialist in high stakes litigation, but he carries New Orleans in his heart and really came through for us. It's been a long track for everybody involved the last 5.5 years, really the major work on my part, but I'm quite pleased with it.
Well, congratulations, and let's talk again soon. It's always a delight to catch up with Jason Berry. The documentary is City of a Million Dreams. The book, if you haven't read it, it's a must read for anyone who loves New Orleans and Louisiana. City of a Million Dreams, a history of New Orleans at year 300. Jason, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Jim, always a pleasure.
And we're about to go to Glenn Gilbo with the latest on the Coach O saga, but a reminder that we do have 7 minutes to go in this hour, and we'd like to hear from you, and you'll show your support for this hour of programming. And is Sustaining Member Monday, you become a monthly sustaining member at any amount, and the first 6 months of your membership will be matched. So that's a good addition. Thanks to Steve Milling, Clinton, Louisiana, another caller who have contributed in the last few minutes. And again, the number is 855-893-9753. To show your support for WRKF, you're in and out in fewer than 89.3 seconds, 855-893-9753. And yesterday was quite an eventful day in the sporting world in Louisiana. And once again, we managed to grab headlines while the baseball playoffs are going on and NFL games are in full bloom, although the Saints had the week off. But it was Coach O who was there on a lot of national programs, lead story. Just 21 months after winning it all on January 13th, 2020, he's out of a job on October 17th, 2021, but he gets $17 million in walking away money. And it comes on the heels of a stirring victory over Florida, 49-42 at Tiger Stadium. Glenn Gilbo, Tiger Rag columnist, and now without kick the coverage. Glenn, what do you think? What did you make of what happened on Sunday?
LSU is just a strange place. It's one of the strangest football programs in the country, I think. Just, you know, it's just weird. Here he wins a big game, but he was fired already, you know, and before even the midpoint of the season. Tremendous buyout. Why? I don't know. Why he would have such a large buyout, that's ridiculous too. But LSU is able to throw around money whenever they really need it for football. It's amazing.
And that's the school with the smallest endowment in the Southeastern Conference at about $600 million. But Coach O has been – go ahead, Glenn. Go ahead. You were going to say something.
And one of the worst libraries ever.
Yeah, bad library, no doubt. No doubt.
It's an embarrassment. It really is an embarrassment.
And Glenn – went to both LSU and the University of Missouri, which I presume has a better library, but not as good a football team. And at LSU, if you go 9-8, as Coach O has done over the last 17 games, that's not good enough. Scott Woodward says he's looking now for the next championship coach. But coming here, think about that. The last two coaches have won national championships and still got fired. Oh, does that perhaps give someone pause when they're saying, should I leave East Lansing, Michigan for Baton Rouge, or should I leave State College PA for Baton Rouge? Will it be easy to get a big-name coach?
You know, you would think it would be because, you obviously have a chance to win a national championship if a couple of guys who got fired won national championships. And who weren't, and both Les Miles and Coach O, when they got the LSU job, it's not like they were the hottest name in the country, you know. Especially Coach O, he was a lifelong assistant coach, other than a bad experience at Ole Miss and an interim job at USC. He wasn't on the fast track.
All right. I've got a couple questions here from listeners. The Title IX stuff, that was largely unmentioned yesterday. Did that have anything to do with this?
Well, I think it may have. And shame on us for not asking that question. I was going to ask it, but they didn't get to me. I should have asked it at my first question. But I've heard some theories that may have had something to do with it, and LSU felt motivated to remove a possible witness or someone with knowledge of.
All right. Well, we're short on time. We have some people lined up. We'll bring Glenn back soon, but I do want to slide in one caller, Londra, who we're going to take. Tim and Thibodeau. Tim, please be brief. You're on with Glenn. Hi, Tim. Go ahead, Tim.
Glenn, I just want to know, everybody can accuse everybody else of all sorts of indiscretions here. However, LSU seems to be entirely consistent, whether one likes it or not, because Miles was fired after a national championship, and in fact, O was brought in when Miles was 2-2, and his sin was not other stuff, which ultimately came out, but it was losing to Auburn.
All right, yeah. Winning is the bottom line. Just win, baby, as Al Davis used to say.
Well, Scott Woodward was asked if Coach O's bad.
We got a roll. I'm so sorry. But thanks to Catherine Wells, who called in the last few moments. And again, 855-893-9753. Show your support for WRKF. Signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting.